I wish I could were clever enough on my feet to think of a way to transition from that marvelous talk that we just had. I was thinking of changing the title of my talk from Windows and Mirrors to Ernie and Bert, but I can't really justify it, so I'm just going to go ahead with what I did have to say, which I think has something to do rather with the first session this morning more than the two talks that we've just heard. Nevertheless, what I'd like to do is really to make what I think is a very simple point, perhaps an obvious point, about the relationship of digital artifacts to the history of visual representation, about how our notions of computer interfaces are supposed to function, about the dominance of one model of representation among computer interface and application designers. As I said, I think this is an obvious point, but in many years of analyzing digital media, I've discovered that what I think is obvious, others often not only don't find obvious, but they don't even find to be true. So with that proviso, I'd like to offer the following tentative observation. Let me begin with the human-computer interface expert, Donald Norman. In 1998, in The Invisible Computer, Norman told us that computers as we know them are going to disappear. We will continue to use computers, of course, but they will disappear from view as they are absorbed into, quote, information appliances, such as electronic calendars, cell phones, portable email readers, and so on. We won't care much that there's a digital processor inside these appliances. We will care that each appliance accomplishes a task for us. Now, at one level, Norman's argument is convincing when we look around at all the devices from PDAs to automobiles that depend on computer chips of some sort. At the same time, it's patently wrong. Computers and digital devices aren't hiding. They're everywhere. They are objects of design and objects of commodity fetishism. Consider the success, for example, of the iMac in recent years as a computer design, as a computer because of its design. Norman's argument does not take into account the diversity of our often contradictory cultural reactions to digital technology. Nevertheless, interface and computer designers have generally, but not always, assumed Norman's point of view. Since the 1970s, the dominant interface and application design ideas have worked under the representational strategy of transparency, making the computer, its interface, transparent to the user has been the goal. Ironically, the GUI, the graphical user interface, which made the computer so prominent and visible in our culture, was based on this strategy of transparency. We can trace transparency as a representational strategy, of course, through the history of painting, photography, and even modernist graphic design. And let me stress that I understand that there was never that this was never the only strategy of Western representation, even in the period from the Renaissance to the 19th century. But it was a powerful strategy, often a dominant one. And it is dominant, as I say, in the graphical user interface. The key element of the GUI is, after all, the window. When interface designers chose the name window to describe the framed rectangles on the screen that present text and graphical data, they made a choice that had cultural resonance. And as a result, we've been spending the last 20 years opening, staring at, resizing, minimizing, and closing windows. The most widely used single piece of software on Earth is named for that metaphor. Just as we look through a window in the physical world, the GUI's window metaphor suggests that the interface can present data, words, images, just as they, quote, really are, without distorting them. That words and images are in there, just beyond the window, and available for our manipulation. The interface designer's task is to make the interface transparent to that data. By evoking the window's metaphor, the designers were falling back on the powerful cultural metaphor that dates back at least to the Renaissance and Alberti, and in painting, the notion of the painting as the window. And painting, photography, film, and television have all offered versions of this window. The computer is now offering its version. And of course, Lev Manovich, in his book that's been talked about a great deal already today, has explored the metaphor of the window and the computer screen. Furthermore, computer graphics experts soon found that even the GUI was inadequate as a metaphor for transparency, that it was in fact not transparent enough. So they dream of going beyond the GUI. In fact, they dreamed of it even before the GUI was perfected. For example, Ivan Sutherland, the man who more or less invented computer graphics and did invent virtual reality, came up with the metaphor of jumping into the computer screen and being immersed in a computational world, jumping through Alberti's window. And that brings me to virtual reality and the strategy of transparency. Because virtual reality is often portrayed as the ultimate transparent medium. In fact, real virtual reality, that is to say, the production systems created and used by computer scientists, cannot achieve this transparency. The technology is relatively crude in this respect. It requires still rather bulky headsets, as you can see in this image. And and in this image you can see a cartoon, the cartoon-like graphics that one often associates with real virtual reality production systems. The reason the graphics have to be relatively crude is that they have to be drawn in real time, and you can't get photorealistic effects even with expensive virtual reality technology in real time at 15 frames per second. But the cultural significance of VR depends not so much on its technological achievements as on its status as the paradigm of the computer as a perceptual medium. VR is to this conception of the computer what artificial intelligence was to the computer in the 1960s. The cultural meaning of VR can therefore be found in Hollywood films about virtual reality as much as in actual virtual reality applications. And if we look at the VR films, we find the technology is in fact portrayed as transparent, as it is, for example, in the movie Strange Days, a movie that offers a vision of the near future in which the government has perfected a form of virtual reality called The Wire that puts other people's perceptions directly into the user's mind. The Wire is being used in the movie for black market purposes by people like Lenny, the main character of the film. Here's how Lenny describes the perfect transparency of virtual reality to a potential customer to whom he's trying to sell his black market goods.
Now listen, I want you to know what we're talking about here, okay? This is not like TV, only better. This is life. Piece of somebody's life. Pure and uncut, straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there, you're doing it, you're seeing it, you're hearing it, you're feeling it.
What kind of things, exactly?
Anything, it's whatever you want, whoever you want to be, okay? I mean, if you want to go skiing without leaving your den, you can, but I'm assuming that a guy like you, you want to go skiing, you fly to Aspen. That's not what you're interested in here. About the stuff that you can't have, right? The forbidden fruit, Like running into a liquor store with a .357 Magnum in your hand, feeling the adrenaline pumping through your veins, huh? Or, see that guy over there with the drop-dead Filipino girlfriend? I'm just going to be that guy for 20 minutes, the right 20 minutes. Yeah, and I can make it happen, and you won't even tarnish your wedding ring. That sounds good. I can get you what you want. I can get you anything. You just have to talk to me. You have to trust me. If you trust me, because I'm your priest. I'm your shrink. I am your main connection to the switchboard of the soul. I'm the magic man. The Santa Claus of the subconscious. You say it. You think it. You can have it.
I love the way that transparency is figured as dangerous and at the same time very attractive, seductive in this portrayal in this film. And notice that Lenny goes through three historical promises of transparency in the figure of the priest, the psychiatrist, and then the switchboard operator. In the movie, it's technology in the end that promises this transparent immediacy. Now, this is admittedly a cinematic version of virtual reality. It's what a colleague of mine, Ellen Strain, called in a recent article, virtual reality. not what we what real virtual reality can ever achieve, but it reflects, in fact, Hollywood's anxiety that virtual reality might succeed, might actually replace traditional film as the most important popular transparent medium for our culture. Okay, so we see the strategy of transparency pursued in and associated with digital technologies in our culture. Okay, I would like to reiterate again that transparency is only one possible representational strategy, and that another strategy has existed in Western culture that subverts, undermines, critiques the goals of transparency. That this has been true at least since the Renaissance in the world of art, with the self-referential techniques employed by Dutch and Northern painters, the use of mirrors, anamorphic painting, and on, and certainly continues into the 20th century and beyond with certain variants of modernism. This second strategy, the strategy of critique or undermining transparency, is one that gets picked up in the digital world in digital art by the community of artists who use digital technologies to create their own new media forms. And it's digital art that I now want to talk about for a minute. In fact, I want to regard digital art as a kind of radical interface design whose purpose is to point out alternatives to the accepted practices of building computer interfaces and artifacts and to the standard roles assigned to those artifacts. And I want to highlight digital art's work in setting up a counterpart to the strategy of transparency, a counterpart that I'll characterize as reflectivity. Instead of the figure of the clear glass, the window, digital artists often give us the figure of the mirror, the reflective interface that reflects the user herself as a subject, or the process by which the artifact is constructed, or the various physical and cultural contexts of production. The world of digital art over the last three decades is, of course, large and varied. Let me focus specifically on one venue for digital art, the art gallery of the SIGGRAPH conventions. SIGGRAPH is the main computer conference on graphics and interactivity that each year brings 30,000 or more people together, participants and visitors from the academic community and also from the business community of the business industry of digital media. And in the middle of SIGGRAPH is an art gallery of digital art. The Millennial Art Gallery of the year 2000 was curated by my colleague Diane Gramala, and I would like to just for a few minutes illustrate the reflectivity of digital art with three pieces that occurred in that gallery, the first of which is called Text Rain. I'm sorry, these slides are just by example, but obviously it's a little light to see. Text Rain, created by Camille Utterbach and Romy Archituf, was one of the most striking exhibits in SIGGRAPH 2000, consisting of two large parallel screens, one featuring projected video, while the other screen served as a backdrop. These screens form a corridor about 10 feet wide within the gallery, and no one passed through that corridor without glancing up at the screen, slowing their walk, and then stopping at least briefly to take part in the show. As the visitor immediately discovers, she herself becomes the work when her face and figure are caught by the video camera and projected on the screen in black and white. At the same time, a rain of colored letters falls steadily from the top of the screen. Wherever the letters come in contact with the viewer's image, they cease to fall. Whenever the viewer moves, the letters that had collected resume their fall. The viewers, when they realize this, instantly want to play, making visual and verbal patterns by holding the letters in their hands or along their arms. They hold up boards or sheets in order to catch the letters and even make them rebound. They use their bodies to channel the falling letters into streams. The experience of Text Rain comes from the interaction of the viewers with the creator's design. Text Rain is a text that its viewers and users help to create, a text that they write in the process of reading. And like most of the other digital installations in the art gallery, Text Rain is therefore about the process of its own making. It's a poem and a video program at the same time. A televisual mirror, and therefore, like so much video art, in part an exploration of narcissism. Nosce te ipsum is another piece that was ultimately a mirror. On a large scrim hanging from the ceiling, the viewer sees projected a contour drawing of an androgynous human figure. The artist who created this work describes the experience. As you move closer to the image, you see a line of words across the floor dotted with circular targets. As you walk forward following the words, you trip a pressure sensor that triggers a change in the animation. Suddenly, layers pull back and reveal that beneath there lies a body composed of flesh, words, letters, and marks. Stepping on each image triggers another sensor and a continued shift in the animation as the body folds back on itself, revealing layers of images that give way to further images. When you step on the final sensor, your face, captured in real time with a video camera, appears beneath the embedded layers. As with Text Rain, this piece, Nosce, turns out ultimately to be a mirror, revealing the user behind layers of self-dissecting images. It's a digital collage or a digital decollage as layer after layer is peeled off until as the viewer moves toward the scrim. As the phrase nosce te ipsum, which is Latin for know thyself, suggests, the user is imagined to learn something about herself as she walks forward and is revealed. As she walks, she reflects on her relationship to the digital application. So we understand Nosce as a lesson in digital design, a comment on digital applications and how they affect us as viewers and users. Nosce is a direct interface because we make the picture simply by walking along the prescribed path, but it is certainly not a transparent window. We do not look through this piece to an imagined world, and we never forget that we are interacting with a digital interface. Nosce shows us how a user interface can be a mirror to reflect us as we use it. My final example is Fake Shop, which explores the multiplicity of digital representation. The myth of transparency is closely related to a belief in the univocality of data and the unified perspective that we are supposed to achieve on data. But in Fake Shop, our perspective is purposely fragmented. We see multiple windows, each of which offers a different kind of information. Streams of information, text, still, and video, are reported through a richly layered interface. This Fake Shop website is a collage of different times and places. It is one expression of the larger Fake Shop project, which is the work of a team of artists combining installation art, web art, and performance elements. And it's also, Fake Shop is also about the human body as a physical presence and about the representations of our bodies that we now send through cyberspace. On the website, we see bodies envisioned in a film, bodies of actors recreating the film, and 3D models of bodies rendered in a 3D program called Poser. We read texts that describe what is happening to our embodied existence in an age of information. The diverse ways in which bodies are presented and represented illustrates the diversity of media and media forms with which we are now surrounded. Fake Shop, in fact, borrows and refashions most of the media that we now find on the World Wide Web. As viewers, users, and participants in the site, our attention is successively drawn in many directions toward the text, images, and particularly the digitized video appearing in the windows, and then back to the windowed interface. The interface itself is a collage of media forms. Well, these three examples from this one digital art show, the SIGGRAPH 2000 Gallery, show the possibilities of the reflective interface, where what is reflected, once again, is the individual subject or the process of the making of the interface or the context, media history context or cultural context of the artifact. And although although these examples come from only one gallery, it's one exhibit, we can, in fact, look beyond them to the whole world of digital art in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. The question then becomes, to what extent is the example of digital art being reflected in digital design in general today? Well, in fact, there are signs that digital design is freeing itself from the total allegiance to the single strategy of transparency. And I would point in particular to applications in what's called ubiquitous computing, augmented reality, and mixed reality. Mark Weiser's pioneering work in the early 1990s added a new term to the digital lexicon, ubiquitous computing, referring to computers and computing devices that are scattered throughout the physical world in constant communication with us and with each other. The emphasis in augmented reality on embodiment and on the relationship to the physical world is a healthy complement to the apparent rejection of the body in virtual reality. Weiser, in fact, coined the term embodied virtuality to describe what he had in mind. And that reminds us that digital designs always intersect with our physical world, that they cannot escape from the world into pure cyberspace. While virtual reality seems to eliminate the computer as it takes the user into a graphical world, ubiquitous computing or embodied virtuality does just the opposite. As I say, it scatters computational devices throughout our environment. With ubiquitous computing, the computer joins us in our physical world, while with virtual reality, we are forced to join the computer in its world. Ubiquitous computing recognizes, therefore, the divergence and diversity of computer design, while VR wants to be the ultimate convergence. Other researchers today are working on applications in what's called mixed reality and augmented reality, in which, similar to UbiComp, the computer systems place virtual images around us in our physical environment. These technologies, too, tend to be reflective in the sense that they require both the designers and the users to think about their subject position, the physical environment in which the technologies function, and the social and cultural arrangements within which the technologies function. Well, I've set up a dichotomy here, then, between two strategies of representation, between transparency and reflectivity, or the window and the mirror. And as we know, such dichotomies are made to be collapsed. Both strategies of representation have a place in our culture's construction of the digital. In general, we want our interfaces to oscillate between transparency and reflectivity. There are times when we want to look through the computer window to the data beyond, but there are also times when we want to look at the window, at the interface, to adjust the size of the window, to alter the parameters of the interface, and especially when the program itself malfunctions. The desire for transparency has been so strong, particularly among computer designers and enthusiasts, that it needs a corrective, the emphasis on the reflective interface. And it is digital art that is now providing that emphasis. Thank you.